Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and it's time for another edition of Crave, the podcast about music and films and anything else that's been keeping me and Steve McKay amused recently. Today we're looking at Hunger Games, Mockingjay, Part 2.
And not an at all awkwardly titled film, is it?
Not a bit.
Now, I've been to see the programme.
And Steve also saw 10cc last week in Auckland.
Now, there's a name from the past, eh?
Oh, yeah, I like to hear about that.
Oh, yeah. And I've also been talking to Gareth Williams. He's the director of Basement Theatre's Christmas production, Jesus Christ Part 2.
The Return of.
Yes, who knew there would be a sequel?
Okay, and also we'll squeeze in a thought or two on the brand new, much anticipated album called 25 from Adele, of course. But let's start with, as you say, Steve, the rather awkwardly, fully titled Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2. What did you make of it?
I'm going to get into a lot of trouble with this review from my daughter.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, go ahead. Yes, yes.
I took my daughter to see this.
Yes.
Took my wife as well, for that matter. And at the end of it, in the car, on the way home, they turned to me and they said, right, what did you think of it? And I said, I have got so many problems with that film on so many levels, I don't even know where to start.
And they said?
Well, my daughter, 18 years old and a fan, took great umbrage. But it was brilliant. It was fantastic. It was wonderful. And I had to explain to her that no, it actually seriously wasn't.
Okay.
Now, my objection to this film, in some ways, go back to when I actually read the very first of the Hunger Games novels. Just by way of setup, and I don't know if we even really need to set this up too much, because a lot of people are going to be interested in this film will have read the books anyway.
Yeah.
Or at the very least will be familiar with where the story was left, which again is one of the issues I have with it. But the bottom line is we've got Katniss Everdeen, who is now the Mockingjay, the symbol of some sort of insurrection or revolution in the bizarrely corrupt country of Panem. And she's leading a revolution. She's in the middle of a revolution. As the film opens. And this was my first issue with it. When we went to see the second film in the Quaternity, when we saw Catching Fire, I remember the climactic sequence, which was quite dramatic and quite cliffhangery.
Yes.
And then the title started rolling. I'm thinking, what? I paid to see a film, not half a film.
Yeah.
And I was taken to task and told that that's how the book ends. And I said, well, that's a crap ending for a book too. It's incomplete. It's half of a story. It's not the whole thing. And it felt like we're watching an episode, and this was the commercial break. And it was very frustrating. I didn't even bother seeing, and this is possibly a failing of mine as a reviewer, I don't know, but I didn't even see Mockingjay Part 1. I don't feel like I missed a whole lot. But the film opened, Mockingjay 2 opened, completely cold, as though we'd just come back after the adverts on a TV show.
It did. Yes, it did. You're right. Yep.
There was no attempt to provide continuity or setting. There wasn't even a previously on. It just kicked off. And that, from the beginning, made me think, no, people are just milking this. They were milking the story. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I mean, I know I'm not, but correct me if I'm wrong.
The
film, my daughter insists, had to be that long to fit everything in. No, it didn't. The film is 2.25 hours long. It could have been an hour long. Basically, my issue with the very first film, the first book, was as long as they were doing the political ideas, the backstory, the way that the country worked and the Hunger Games and the districts and all the rest, it was interesting. There was a really cool idea at work there.
Yeah.
The moment she put them in the arena for the games themselves, I got bored. The action sequence was half of the book. It was half of the film. And frankly, except for one small twist at the end, just in case no one's read the book or seen the film, apart from the twist at the end, you knew basically where it was going. And it was excessively drawn-out action sequence. And the entire of Mockingjay 2 is basically a grown-up Hunger Games.
Yeah, it is. It is. It makes a massive assumption that you know exactly what's happened before, because you say you're dropped right into the middle of it. No introduction, just right, let's carry on. I'm very similar to you, Steve. This film, or this whole sequence of stories, was also recommended to me by my daughter. And she had seen the first film, really recommended it to me. I actually didn't go to the theatre to see it. I watched them, all of them, on a DVD.
Right.
So maybe I might have missed out something of the grand experience. And I from the first, I thought, oh, look, this is one of these other Have I seen this sort of futuristic drama on the theme of insurrection against an oppressive government or ruler before? I think I have. And I remember that first film, Steve, something about the actual, the Hunger Games itself brought to mind an old, I'm sort of embarrassed to say this, but an old Arnold Schwarzenegger film called Running Man, which is probably about 20 years at least old, maybe 30. Mm. And I that brought that to mind. I thought, well, this is all rather derivative. But I do think Jennifer Lawrence is a good actress. I think she's a genuinely good actress, and she has to be because it's the story is hers, and she's got to carry it, doesn't she?
And rather unfortunately, while she is a phenomenal actress, I did feel that because of the nature of the story, and I don't think this is a criticism of her particularly, I think it's a criticism of all that she was given to do, was look angry and look intense and look furious, and there was no light and no shade. Everything was maxed up to the max, all the way, maxed out, maximum everything. It was dialed up to what goes beyond 11, 12. There you go. Of course, that's just, it was dialed. There was no relief anywhere in it. It was just intense all around her, though. Were people like Woody Harrelson and Donald Sutherland and Julianne Moore. Phenomenal screen presences, all of them. And Woody Harrelson in particular, I think, makes these films. Of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was just spliced in where they could, almost in tribute to him.
Yes.
But all these wonderful screen presences who added a little bit of... you can't say levity because this was never going to be a comedy, but light and shade, a bit of okay, you can let go just for a second. You're not being yelled at constantly. They added a little bit of variation, a bit of range to the performances, and all that Jennifer Lawrence is allowed to do in this film is emote herself to death.
Yes, and in fact, when she's not angry and determined, she's having to deal with this love triangle, which does drag on and is drawn out, isn't it? I thought, oh, gosh, that needed to be dealt with in a tidier way, I thought. But anyway, all these other characters, the ones they've been peppered through the story all the way through, they're still there. Stanley Tucci makes a very brief appearance this time as this TV host. I think he's a real card, that guy. I think he's fantastic. I actually wrote down... I made a couple of notes, Steve, almost exactly what you said. I thought flattened parts, dragged on a bit, wanted them to get on with it, just stretched more than it needed to be. There were a couple of decent action sequences in it, but I think maybe, Steve, if we were of a different... sorry, this sounds terrible, but maybe there is an aspect of an appeal here to a female audience that you and I don't get. Is that possible?
I think that there's gender divides, there's generational divides.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think we're on the wrong side of both of those.
Oh dear! Yeah, but possibly. Yes,
I wanted to like it. I really did. I mean, part of it is because it would have made the ride home in the car a lot more pleasant. But I wanted to be able to have nice things to say. And one of the things I thought was emblematic of. I mean, you mentioned things being overlong, and if you remember the sewer scene.
Yes.
Was way longer than it needed to be. The entire film should have been an hour long. The entire film should have been the second hour of Mockingjay Part the Only One, and it wasn't. It shouldn't have been spun out separately because it didn't stand alone as a film. You can't see this without having seen Part One, and I think that's a huge weakness that we've had to deal with since the Harry Potter people decided that they could bleed that stone a bit further. I think it's very unfortunate that we're now doing this, but at the very, very end of the film, you'll possibly remember the scene. It's Katniss Everdeen's big emotional release, and Jennifer Lawrence throws everything she's got at it. It's a fantastically emotional performance. But then perhaps the director's made a misstep by cutting to her pet cat, and the audience in the cinema I saw it in Pukekohe laughed.
I thought
you've lost them, mate.
Yeah.
When that's the reaction you're getting from that scene, you've not won your audience at all. It was very, very disappointing.
Okay, so are you recommending we go out and buy a ticket for this, Steve? I'm thinking not.
Nah, wait till you can download it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge... I hadn't read the books, okay? I have to admit that I hadn't read them, so there was a curiosity factor there for me to... see how it ended. There was a twist, but I think most of us would have seen the twist coming right at the end.
Yes, very much so.
Very much so. Not pretty easy to spot. So I think, you know, if you've seen all the others and you don't know what's coming, sure, go and see it, so at least you know how it's all tidied up. But and Jennifer Lawrence is good, but it's not a slam dunk or even close to one.
Not even remotely.
Right, we've dealt with that. Poor Jennifer Lawrence.
She'll get over it, mate. Don't worry. I'm sure there's several. I mean, each of those millions of dollars she got made. And yes, I know she doesn't make as many millions as the gentleman around her. She's still making more than we're making.
And then some.
Yes. And she'll get over our criticisms. I'm sure she will.
Yeah. This is Crave, our weekly or so podcast about entertainment with Steve McCabe and Simon Mercier. Now, another film that I haven't seen but Steve has, a very well-known true life story, one of the most infamous athletes in modern history. In fact, in all history, really, one Lance Armstrong. This is The Program, Steve.
Yeah, I don't think you're overselling that one at all. He is remarkably well-known for, first of all, being... to begin with, the most successful competitive cyclist in the world, and then latterly as possibly the most corrupt cheat in the history of any sport. Now, there has been an attempt to present his story in documentary format, but the program is Stephen Frears. Is the gentleman's name, is the director, has chosen, possibly somewhat redundantly, to dramatise this. I'm not quite sure what the point was.
Okay, well, my first question is this. Is it trying in any way to paint this man as a full character so that you somehow have some sympathy for him, or is he just a bad guy?
Well, see, I kept wondering where they were going to go with it. First of all, my bottom line on Armstrong, my opinion is he is a cheat. He's a liar, and he's quite an ugly character from what I can tell. So I got very, very nervous in places when it looked like they were starting to try and redeem him. And not having him earn his redemption, but making it easy. Just off tossing out little nuggets. It starts off basically trying to present the idea that, well, I had to do this because everybody else is doing it. But the fact is that he did it, knowing it was wrong. But it's set up as though, well, what else can I do? One of the very first sequences is he realizes that other riders in low-level races that he's riding in France and in Belgium are taking a hormone called erythropoietin, which promotes red blood cell growth. And it presents him finding out that a certain doctor is providing this to a racing team, a doctor by the name of Michel Ferrari, played with the most annoying accent I think I've ever heard. By Guillaume Canet. I hope I've mispronounced his name. He deserves it. But he plays it with. It's like a German doing an impersonation of a Frenchman trying to be Italian. It was a horrendous accent. But we see Lance Armstrong, played by Ben Foster, rather one dimensionally, it has to be said. Thinking, well, poor old me, the only way I can get ahead is by taking these drugs. And so he goes ahead and takes them. We don't see any sort of real emotional anguish. He goes, oh, well, that's what you do, isn't it? I'll just do it. There's no emotional development in him. All we see is a man who has to win. We don't know why. We don't know what happened in his childhood that made him as determined as he is. We just see that whether he's cycling or he's playing table football, he's playing miniature golf, he has to win. He's clearly a phenomenally driven man, but we don't know why. And a film like this ought to be giving us that story. That's what a film like this can provide. I mean,
some insight.
Well, the analogy is going to be, I mean, you recently saw, remind me of the name of the film, of the guy walking between the two buildings on the tightrope.
The walk.
So the walk is going to be the dramatization, which then gets under the skin of the characters in a way that Man on Wire couldn't.
Yeah,
that was the premise, and that was supposedly the idea with the program, but it didn't. All it shows is a man who has to win at all costs, and again, a bit like Jennifer Lawrence, very one note, very flat, very intense. The man can't smile. The man is simply, I'm driven all the way through it. And the sad thing is, he's got Chris O'Dowd on screen with him. Chris O'Dowd, one of my favorite actors ever, playing David Walsh, the journalist who finally, basically uncovered the nonsense that was going on. I could watch him from now till Christmas. Amazingly, even he comes off a bit flat sometimes. There's one fantastic sequence where there's a bunch of sports journalists sitting in a cafe together, and it sounds as though they are all reading their own reports to each other. It's one of the most staged pieces of acting I've seen on screen for a very, very long time. No, it doesn't really do much to give you an insight, to get under the skin of why Armstrong was such a willing cheat and such a manipulator and such a very, very profoundly deceitful character. There are moments when it shows him as being very ugly.
Yeah. Actually, can I just say that that's a big fail, because the fact that in professional cycling there's been dope taking, we've known that for years and years, and that the excuse that everyone does it, we've known that for years and years and years. So that's not bringing anything new to the table to portray that. What we needed to know is, as you say, why he kept going and why, when he was continually confronted with it, he lied all the time. He lied for years.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to find out from this film. What was going on in his mindset that thought, I'm actually going to get away with this, because inevitably, sooner or later, you're going to get caught out. And he did.
Yeah. I mean, was he hurt as a child? Was he deprived? I mean, what happened to the man? We don't know. We are no closer to understanding him at the end than we were at the beginning. I think that is a huge failing in a film like this. There's very occasional moments when it looks like they're trying to redeem him. Like, for example, there's a scene when he goes to visit a hospital and he's on his way out. His eye is caught by the one very, very sick kid named Jack, and he has to go and have a quiet sacramental moment with Jack. And so, the comment I made in my little notes as I was going through it was, are they trying to make out that he's a private saint? But then that was it. This one brief episode. That's just like almost rude. What's the word I'm looking for here? Not rudimentary. What? Get me out of here. I can't English tonight.
Are you doing well?
Yes, I'm doing my best. It's just tossed in as there you go. We'll tick that box. We can move on now. It didn't really work, and I wasn't very happy with the way they did it. In fact, at one point, you know, and it's interesting how you can start getting sort of meta-referential when you got a true story. But they're talking about having Jake Gyllenhaal playing Lance Armstrong in a putative film of the man's story when he was still a hero. And one of the characters remarks, well, yeah, why do you need Jake Gyllenhaal? Just because he can ride a bike. And I'm thinking, well, that's all you really need to do to play this character. That and be a bit angry and snarky in a press conference when you can turn to people and say, I can destroy you. That's all he really does, and it's such a shame. He has no periphery. So when they mock up the famous Oprah interview and he mentions that I did have the perfect story with the perfect wife and kids, you're thinking, really? You have a wife and kids? Why? We saw your wedding very briefly. That was one scene with Mrs. Armstrong. Where's the wife and kids of which you speak? Nothing of the man. And
yeah, what a shame.
Big shame.
Actually, just quickly on that, Steve, I was wondering whether in this film, among the other relationships he had with women, I'm sure he had a relationship for a while with the Sheryl Crow, the rock singer Sheryl Crow.
She gets one passing mention.
Does she? Oh, okay.
It's mentioned in a litany of celebrities with whom he is now acquainted. Her name gets mentioned in passing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He moved in wonderful circles. And let's face it, Sheryl Crow has always been something of a collector of celebrities herself. And so they were something of a match made in heaven. But that was just, you know, mentioned in passing. Again, a ticking of a box, I think, to be honest.
All right. Well, I think, Steve, finish off.
I was going to say, let's face it, to be absolutely honest, when you've got someone like Stephen Frears telling this story, you expect an awful lot better. The man is capable of an awful lot more. If you saw the film Philomena that came out about 3 years ago, story of what's her name? Judi Dench, playing the woman who has to go and try and find the child she gave up for adoption.
Okay, I've heard of it, didn't see it, but I heard it was very well reviewed.
Wonderful, wonderful film. And again, it's he casts, in that case, Steve Coogan, as an investigative journalist who's digging up an ugly story. And it was phenomenal, absolutely brilliant. When you know what the man's capable of, you wonder how he manages to turn out such a flat film.
I am not going to see this film, based on what you've just told me.
No, I wouldn't bother, quite frankly.
Okay. oh, Mr. Frears, better next time, please, I'd say.
Because I'm sure he's listening.
Now, let us move, we mentioned Sheryl Crow, let us take that little nugget of a name and move on to some music, shall we? You say to me 10cc, and I say, I'm not in love, and I say, Dreadlock Holiday, and then I say, I'm not in love, and then I say, Dreadlock Holiday, and I'm trying hard to think of some others because I only listened to them on AM radio when I was in the 70s.
And those were obviously the big hits, the very radio-friendly hits. And why not? I mean, that's what they're famous for. And they're a very talented band.
So you went to see them. They were in Auckland.
Well,
what sort
I mean,
of show
first
it?
Of all, we're using the word they. And I think there's something we need to get past first of all. Right? They were a four-piece from Manchester, I would hasten to add. They were a four-piece. Of the four, only one is still in the band. Can we still say, when it's just Graham Gouldman, the bass player and occasional singer, is it still 10cc?
Oh, is the a bass player and an occasional singer?
He was, to be fair, a major songwriter for them. He did write a lot of their material. He wrote about half the songs they performed.
Oh, okay. Oh,
it redeems it somewhat. It's still a little bit of a stretch. But nevertheless, I mean, they did have... Their guitarist and singer did a very, very close approximation of the band's original singer, whose name rather shamefully escapes me right now, and I should be able to tell you it off the top of my head. Mick Wilson. They had a drummer who was part of the later recording band, but wasn't in the original foursome. But other than that, it was very much Graham Gouldman touring his old band's songs. But when the songs are performed as tightly and as beautifully as they were, he's aligned himself with a very, very talented band. And so, yeah, he played all the hits. I'm Not In Love was gorgeous, as, let's face it, it was always going to be. Dreadlock Holiday was the big closer, the big set closer. Fantastic fun. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, the guy is 60 mumble years old now. And he wanders on stage in very sort of bank manager on the weekend kind of grey slacks, and you think this is going to be rather dull. And his between song patter was very much that of a museum curator describing an exhibit, and yet when he started playing, the music has so much joy in it. It was extraordinary.
Oh, wonderful!
And anything else I've said that sounded very critical until now could be forgiven when he starts playing songs like Good Morning Judge or Rubber Bullets or I'm Mandy Fly Me. There are a lot more songs that they did that you will know if you heard that you just don't realise. Okay. Songs like Art for Art's Sake were great songs.
I thought that was Roxy Music.
Absolutely. Okay. They're a similar sort of slightly arty, slightly rocky kind of band.
Yeah.
And they carved out a niche for themselves doing these wonderful, seemingly throwaway bubblegum songs that actually had a fantastic amount of depth to them.
Good stuff. Hey, so how long a show did they put on?
About an hour and a half. They played about 15 songs.
Yeah.
I mean, not every single song was a complete hit and a complete showstopper. From Rochdale to Ochos Rios was as disposable a song as I've heard in quite some time. But at the same time, when they're playing... I'm trying to think what else they played. Wall Street Shuffle was brilliant. And again, these are songs that you would know. If they came on the radio, you'd start humming along with them without even realising it. And what's even more telling is... Gouldman did his own support act as Graham Gouldman rather than as 10cc. Because before... the band coalesced into its own discrete thing. All the various members of the band were writing songs for other people. And so he played a smattering of like Holly's songs, for example, that he'd written. And the support set closed, it was an acoustic support set that closed with the Yardbirds hit For Your Love.
Oh,
he wrote
that.
Eric Clapton played it on the recording, but he wrote it. That's how talented this bloke clearly is.
Yeah. Okay. So that's actually a pretty good night out.
Fantastic. I'm really, really glad I went.
Excellent. And by the way, what sort of, where did they play? What sort of crowd did they get?
Now, they played at the Altea Centre in Auckland, so it's about a couple of thousand people. Not massive. Yeah. Which meant that, you know, I was sitting two rows from the front, and it was very, 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 very agreeable little setup. I felt for the first time at a concert in many years, I felt young. It was definitely a very, very middle-aged audience, but it was lovely. I can't remember the last time I saw an audience enjoy themselves, just get into a show as much as especially for Dreadlock Holiday, middle-aged women dancing up and down the aisles. It was lovely to see.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, that's it. Good stuff. Lovely, lovely. Music, but musical theatre, musical rock theatre, rock opera, what are we going to call this? If you say music and Jesus Christ, I think of Jesus Christ Superstar, but a different take on that is about to be launched on the unsuspecting public. Steve, tell me about
that. This is a very, very interesting sounding show that's coming up at the Basement Theatre in Auckland starting later this week. They're putting on a show. A lot of the people who were involved in last year's performance production at the Q Theatre of Jesus Christ Superstar are putting on a production of what they're calling Jesus Christ Part 2. I think the best thing we can possibly do right now is, rather than try and do it justice ourselves, I think we should take a listen to an interview I recorded earlier this week with Gareth Williams, who's the director and the... well, not the writer, and you'll find out why when you listen.
There we go.
Pop that right down there. Well, first of all, thank you very much for the time today. Sorry about last week, by the way. I know I sort of delayed...
that's fine. Things are bouncing all over the place with the rehearsals.
Right.
Right, how's that going?
It's going good, yeah. I'm going to pop up there at 5 o'clock and start today's ones. So.
Yeah, fair enough. When is your open?
27th. Friday.
Next Saturday, mate.
Isn't it Friday?
Next Friday, mate.
Yeah. Right. He keeps telling me the wrong date. He's right. The producer.
Okay, so what's the official answer then?
27th. Which is whatever date that is, I believe it's the Friday. Yeah.
It's a day, and on that day the show will open. Fair enough. Yeah. So tell me about the show.
Well, it's a Christmas extravaganza. It's called Jesus Christ Part 2.
Right.
And essentially, it is the second coming of Jesus.
Okay, fair enough.
The basic storyline is that the world is screwed up.
Yeah.
Which is not, you know, necessarily far away from the truth.
You'll get.
I think most people would agree.
Yeah.
And God has had enough, and He wants to have a little rapture. And basically, what He needs to do is, in order to truly prove once and for all that humans are good. And that humanity is good, he needs to send Jesus or a prophet back there again to do what he did the first time. Except the old Jesus is sort of long gone; he's a bit of a delinquent. So he gets someone to birth a new Jesus.
Okay.
And every night that Jesus is played by a special guest.
Right, and I understand you have a rotating.
Yeah. So the only change in cast is the guest.
Okay.
So there's a core cast of actors. It's a musical.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I forgot to mention that one.
Musical about Jesus. That's been done before, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yeah.
Okay.
Not in exactly this way, but this is a bit different. No one's ever made one about the second coming of Christ.
No, not yet that I'm aware of.
No. I mean, there's probably one out there if we really searched for it.
You can find anything.
Exactly. Everything's been done, right?
Okay.
So different celebrities, or not necessarily celebrities, but different comedians, actors from around Auckland theatre community.
Right.
Will be performing one new Jesus every night.
Right. So, what is the plural of Jesus?
Jesus?
Yeah, that'll go. We'll do that, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So tell me, who's going to be playing the various Jesus?
So, I mean, who do we have? We have lots of different people. Guy Montgomery, Nick Sampson. We've got people like Joel Tobik, Antonia Preble, Kimberly Crossman. Lots of different sort of people. TV personalities, theatre personalities, comedians.
Yeah.
You know, some of them aren't necessarily all actors.
Right. How did you select your shortlist?
Well, actually, I mean, that is a large part of it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's a lot of people who participate in the Christmas shows every year. And then, obviously, each year, you know, there are different people who are available and who aren't, so we sort of change it up. But we wanted to pick people who were au fait with the whole idea of coming in and being a Jesus, and they don't actually know what's going on.
I'm looking for spoilers here, obviously.
No, yeah, so they basically, I mean, this is the audience can know this, I think, which is that the Jesus is turning up, and all they know is that they're Jesus.
Right.
They come as their own version of what Jesus would be to them.
Okay. Yeah.
And they turn up and portray Jesus, but they don't actually know what this exact story is that they're portraying.
So it's semi-improv.
It's semi-improv, yeah. A large amount of it.
What a fantastic idea.
Yeah, so a large amount of it is improv. So the guests are thrust into scenes where they soon learn the gist of what's happening, but they don't have any idea beforehand of what they're going to be doing.
Right.
Now, there are a couple of things they do know. They have to perform a song, a lip-synced entrance song, sort of stars in their eyes-y kind of number. And that's kind of their introduction to the audience as Jesus.
Right.
And then they go into a series of different scenes throughout the show that they're thrust into in more of an improv situation. They have to do a dance, they have to sing a song that they've never heard the lyrics or music to before.
What could possibly go wrong?
Everything. That's kind of the aim. The basement shows are meant to be like that. They're meant to be a bit silly.
Yes.
That you want people to sort of stuff things up.
Right.
And that's kind of the humour of it. It's kind of very panto.
The one that's coming to mind, though.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I guess the basement Christmas shows are a modern day panto.
Okay.
You know, or a panto for, say, a younger basement crowd.
Right.
As opposed to, obviously, pantomime has terrible connotations.
Oh, I don't know. That's what I grew up with in England in the
80s. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're great. And actually, a lot of young people are still fun. It just depends on the content is, of course.
Right.
But yeah, it's still the same premise.
So I understand there is also a degree of audience participation.
Yeah, there is a little bit of audience participation, yeah. So the audience have to get involved. At times they actually play people.
Oh, okay.
Within the piece, potentially. I don't know if they should say that, though. That often scares audiences, you know. Soon as, even now, today, audiences still hear interaction. They hear interaction, they go, oh, God, I'm going to be laughed at or made fun of, which is not the case here.
Right.
Not at all. If anyone's going to be made fun of, it'll be the guest, and even then, not really. It's kind of, the style is that it's very much helped along, and it's all part of the story.
Right.
As opposed to doing something outrageously difficult and failing or things like that.
Now, the press release mentioned something about voting at the end on whether or not he gets crucified.
Yeah, there is an element of that,
That's...
So what we're putting it, because the whole idea is we're putting it back to the people of Earth.
Oh, okay.
To humanity, to decide, you know, are humanity, we want to decipher from the night, are people good or are they bad inherently? And what will they do? Will they crucify Jesus? Won't they?
Okay.
And what does that mean? And people will find that out throughout the show, what that means if he's crucified or if he's not crucified.
Right.
Now they can save the world from a rapture, potentially. And
that's very much an Easter story, not a Christmas story.
The crucifixion?
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose it is Easterish. Mm. I mean, it's all kind of...
Or is it in a broad reading here?
It's kind of a broad reading. I mean, I guess it is a slightly less Christmassy, I suppose, in terms of this thing. But I mean, that doesn't... Our pre-reps, it was kind of... We didn't have to necessarily make it super Christmas. Super presents and Santa and all of that kind of thing.
Now, I grew up in England in the late 70s, early 80s. And I remember vividly the fuss around Life of Brian. I mean, there were famously towns that banned it before any cinemas even had been
cast. Yeah, I bet.
To show it. Are you anticipating, are you courting, or have you experienced any kind of allegations of blasphemy?
For this particular project?
Yeah.
Not at the moment, because I guess nobody really knows about it, but there will be. There'll be always someone. Yeah.
Okay, now I see the smile emerging as you say that. Is this something you're actively courting?
No, definitely not. No, I mean, we don't actively court it, but of course, if you come to a Basement Christmas show, any Basement Christmas show ever, if you're looking for offence, you'll find it.
Excellent.
Definitely. But we kind of try to offend everyone equally.
Okay, that's a great quote there.
Because
right,
if you're going to do that, you may as well do it equally. No, we're not singling out any particular set of people or any religion or anything like that. We're just commenting on the whole
hilarity
of... I mean, you know, the idea of those things even existing and prophets coming back to Earth and all that funny stuff.
So there's no education by nuns being worked through here as therapy by proxy?
No. We don't want to offend. That's not the point. That's not the purpose. But it's always good when someone takes offense.
Well, there's only one thing worse than being talked about.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, I think that sounds like it's well worth a visit. The resurrection. We shouldn't call it the resurrection, but we know what you mean, Steve.
Yes.
Jesus Christ Part 2.
Jesus Christ Part 2. Sounds absolutely wonderful. Now, I've been doing all the hard work so far, Simon, today. What do you have to tell us about?
Right. Well, I was interested in another comeback, not of the scale of biblical proportions, but there was a huge, huge amount of anticipation around the world, really, especially in the UK, for the next album, the long-awaited next album from Adele.
Yes.
She had that massive hit a few years ago with an album called 21. Then we were tantalized a little bit, 2 years ago, was it, Steve? She did the theme song for the previous Bond movie, Skyfall.
She did.
Which won her an Oscar. It was a pretty decent Bond song, I thought. So the latest one, called 25, was released last Friday. Now, rather than look for iTunes releases and whatnot, I actually went out and physically bought a CD.
You can do that.
I can. And I was surprised here because I asked, went on the Friday, the 20th, asked the woman behind the counter, hey, have you been selling any of these today? And she said they've been actually flying out of the shop. So that's kind of interesting that sometimes people still want to actually physically have the CD in their hands. And I was thinking this must have been just literally driven off the port, off the boat, into a truck and down to the store. Because when I opened the CD and smelt the little booklet, it smelt of the ink. It was and a really strong inky smell. I thought, wow, this is really hot off the press.
And you don't get that on iTunes, do you? You see, that's why you buy an actual record.
It is. So I was quite pleased to have it. So what I have to say about this is, in my opinion, basically, it's more of what we've heard before. It's still her great voice.
Yep.
It's still songs of heartache, still plenty of piano-driven ballads.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is good and bad. For me, some of the piano-led ballads, there's several of them. There's a good smattering of them here. Two or three of them started to blend into one after a while for me. I just kind of felt I'm hearing the same sort of treatment of the song, just a bit too much. Having said that the first track, which is the first single, it's a big, belting, lushly produced song called Hello. That is one hell of a song, I think, of that genre. She does a fantastic job with it, and I think it's had tens of millions of hits on YouTube already, the video. I thought I wanted her to do some more different treatments to hear that wonderful voice in a different way. There are a few songs where she does it. There are a few tracks where she gets a little poppier, a little more soulful. One song which is mostly guitar, and that was like a wonderful relief. So there were songs like Send My Love to Your New Lover, River Lee, Million Years Ago, that was the one with the guitar, and the album closer one called Sweetest Devotion. They were, I thought they were pretty damn good, and just made you not think of the big piano thing that after a while I was getting a bit tired of. So I think good. I would have liked different treatment. Still got a fantastic voice. She can use her voice to tell a story well. I think that's a big plus for her.
That's a wonderful description, yeah.
Yeah, but just please, Adele, just try some different musical arrangements, or because she can actually do a good pop song, and she could be like a Dusty Springfield. That she can do.
Ooh, wow.
She can do the soul thing when she wants to. I think
yeah.
there's a little bit of that there, but just a bit to me, a bit too much like the previous album.
Well, that was going to be my big question: is if you already own 21, and again, we're starting to see a theme emerging with album titles, because let's remember her very first album was called 19.
Yes, yes.
There's definitely a certain lack of creativity here.
Yeah.
If you already own 19 and 21, do you need 25, or do you already really have it?
I have to say, you've already got it. There's a couple of two or three songs there with just she's beginning to experiment with another way of doing it, which I thought, oh, yeah, give me more of that. But, yeah, it is too much like the others. Just a little sidebar on this. She's actually 27 now, Steve.
Right.
And one of the songs is titled When We Were Young.
Oh, dear.
And I thought, come on.
What the hell are you and I then, mate?
Exactly. Oh, man, you don't have the rights to sing a song called When We Were Young yet.
No, a little bit of me just died inside.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying don't get it. I mean, I think she's a wonderful singer, and I wouldn't dissuade you from getting it, but I just say to you, there's a rider there. Expect mostly more of what you've heard before.
Well, speaking of age, you mentioned that the CDs have been flying off the shelves. Do you think that speaks to the demographic that's buying this?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I would have thought not. I would have thought that this is mainly an artist who's going to appeal to younger people, younger women especially. I don't know. My first thought was, no, it'd be very much into the younger generation who are accessing their music in different ways. But maybe there's something in her style that sort of Shirley Bassey 60s pop diva look image that is attractive to an older audience as well. That might be happening. That's part of her appeal to me, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of feel a bit of Shirley Bassey happening there somewhere.
Very interesting.
Yes. Had you been much of a fan of her before?
Yes and no. I mean, I've listened to the second album, the first one that really came famous, a few times. My big objection, as we've kind of hinted at right now, is that while there are a few standout tracks on it that really give her a chance to put some serious oomph behind a powerful, well put together song, after a while, there's a certain degree of, yeah, okay, now which song is this again?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a bit of sameness, a bit of, yeah, okay, again, it's like things we've talked about in films tonight. We can tick off boxes, can't we? We got the big piano ballad, we got the lush strings, and we've got absolutely the yet another story of He Left Me.
And I'm sure, I mean, that's thousands of artists have sung songs about that and will continue to sing songs along those themes forever and a day, and that's fine, but it just needs a little more variety. Anyway,
I mean, after a while, do you not think, I don't blame him?
That's a tough call.
We'll edit that line out.
No, don't leave it in. Hey, so anyway, speaking of young people, we've got an interesting film to consider next time, Steve, which is about...
I like what you did there. That's,
yeah, yeah.
That's effortless.
We're looking at a film next time about a couple of blokes at the other end of the age spectrum, but it's called Youth.
Ironically.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's Michael Caine and
Harvey Keitel.
There we go. I shamefully forgot his name for a second there. Which, given that he's actually really, really good in this, is rather sinful, isn't it?
No. Anyway, we'll have a great discussion about that. It's a really interesting film. We'll bring you that next time.
Well, we won't say too much right now. Just to remind each other of the fact that we came out of the cinema and stood in the lobby for half an hour taking it to pieces.
That's right, which is a good thing.
It is indeed.
I only wanted to have fun, learning to fly, learning to run. I let my heart decide the way when I was young.
Yeah. Okay, so this has been Crave with Steve McCabe and Simon Mercer. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back very soon. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
So I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Excellent.
Very nice.